The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Lee Oden, author of Optimize, How to Attract and Engage More Customers by Integrating SEO, Social Media, and Content Marketing. And you are listening to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails.
Hello and welcome to this hopefully short-lived series that will be airing in addition to the weekly Marketing Book podcast interviews. I'm your host, Douglas Burdett, and my goal during this unusual time is to reconnect you with past guests on the Marketing Book podcast, share some ideas and inspiration, and maybe a much-needed laugh or two. I've interviewed over 200 authors on the show, and my plan is to continue this series until I either run out of authors or quarantine, whichever comes first. A word of warning, the host and guest may very likely be drinking cocktails during these conversations. I mean, come on, they are recorded during the cocktail hour. To find the show notes for each episode with pictures of each guest and links mentioned in their conversation, visit marketingbookcocktails.com. marketingbookcocktails.com. See what I did there? And if you'd like to join the conversation, email a voice recording to me at douglas@salesartillery.com, and I'll try to include it in a future episode. I'd love to hear from you. Otherwise, connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat. Lee Oden, welcome to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails. How are you?
I'm doing great, Douglas. How are you?
Good. What's going on in your quarantine world?
My quarantine world has been very fruitful, amazingly fruitful.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah. And of course, it's not me being fruitful. It's the fact that I have a great team that I get to work with that does all the actual work. Mm-hmm. And I just get to tell great stories about what they're doing out to the world. So now, what a job I have.
Now, you all had an office, or you have an office, but everyone's had to go home?
Yeah, you know, I was paying attention to the Johns Hopkins data visualization of what was going on in Wuhan and in China, and talked to my management team. It's like, you know, we have remote working in our DNA. We were remote our first 5 or 6 years as a business, and everything's always been in the cloud. I think it might be something for us to think about. And then some articles came out, and we're like, yep, everyone's going to work remote until further notice.
And when do you think that was that you decided that? It sounds like you
might have actually. That was in March.
First half of March?
That was in late March, I think.
Oh, late March.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, middle, late, I don't know, something like that. And it's been good. They're a mature group of individuals. I have great leadership that keeps them motivated, and they're responsible, accountable individuals. And it's a privilege to get to work with them. And, you know, one of the things that our true test is when your team or your coworkers, or your friends or whatever are challenged and you see how they react, you know, and it's been very, very satisfying and very, I feel a lot of gratitude.
That's great.
To see how my team has reacted.
Yeah. Do you think you all will keep the office or maybe scale it down and do more remote work in the future if things get back to whatever normal will be?
Yeah. It's been interesting seeing, you know, what the Silicon Valley, and San Francisco based companies are doing, you know, Microsoft and or Google, I should say, and Twitter, Shopify, and other companies like that are all telling their workers, you can work in remote indefinitely for as long as you want. And companies shutting down their corporate headquarters and setting up small offices. And so, you know, that's something that is interesting to watch. And at the same time, it's very interesting to see how well our team is doing in the current situation, you know, and so maybe we do. I don't know if we, you know, maybe I think we'll maintain an office of some kind for sure. But I've got 10,000 square feet with 50 workstations, and I already don't need that much space. So, mm-hmm. It's something that we're figuring out as we go, but we're being agile.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, we have a much smaller office, and I've decided to let it go. Everybody ran away anyway, and it's just collecting dust. And I thought, you know what? So after like 16 years, I said to the landlord, I just said, well, I guess we're just going to, I don't know what's ahead, yep. but everyone seems to be just fine working remotely. Yep. So Lee, you were an early supporter of the Marketing Book Podcast, and I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
You were on for episode 37 in September of 2015. And today, as we record this, I published episode 280.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, I love doing it. And you just, you know, there's nothing else to do, Lee. Come on. Let's be honest. it's probably one of those case studies of just showing up, you know, consistency, which is like the least sexy aspect of producing content is consistency, but it really seems to, you know, pay off. But for those folks that haven't listened to episode 37, and there are, just so you know, Lee Oden, there are people who listen to that interview every week because there's a lot of binge listening that goes on the Marketing Book Podcast. But I could see it every week. There's people listening to it. But for those who haven't, tell folks who is Lee Oden and what you do.
Sure, sure. Yeah, just some guy.
that's my line.
Yeah, I'm just some guy. I am CEO and co-founder of a B2B marketing agency called Top Rank Marketing. And as you might guess from the name, we were very focused on search marketing when we started. Today, we are very focused on the intersection of content, influence, and search. And we think of ourselves as experience makers. We're trying to create experiences that inspire people. And we do that for companies like Dell and LinkedIn and SAP and had a chance to work with Oracle and Adobe and 3M and lots of other major brands and quite a few mid-market companies as well, pretty much all in the B2B space. And, you know, we have an office in Minneapolis and I get to, you know, marvel at the amazing work that my team does. They're creating content in so many different formats, obviously text and images, video, podcasts, they're doing episodic content, LinkedIn Live. We've created virtual reality experiences. Interactive is really a big piece of what we do. So from the experience standpoint, I think something that's missing in a lot of B2B is, you know, an experience. I mean, it tends to be a bit dry and transactional. You know, they say B2B stands for boring to boring, and we're trying to break that or bust that myth.
thank you for doing that. And so you've got influencer in there, and I want to talk about that. But there's other Lee Oden trivia that people need to know about, which of course is of great interest to me. You're a veteran of the United States Army. Hooah!
Hooah! Yes, yes. I had the very good fortune. Meaning that it was a good experience for me. Right out of high school, I wasn't quite sure my next step, and I had always had an affinity around the military. And so I joined and
we were, before we were recording, you mentioned both your grandfathers were in World War II.
They were. Yes. Yes. In Europe. Yep. Yep. And, I was a combat engineer in Anchorage or, Fort Richardson, Alaska, for 2 years. And,
cause Minneapolis wasn't cold enough for you.
No. I mean, you really haven't lived until you've flown in helicopters through the mountain passes as the pilot wants to impress the lieutenant that's with you and make the private lose his cookies. That was amazing. Drop you off in the middle of nowhere with three or four other guys and say, okay, now make it back. And it really was actually a great experience. It really was. I was exposed to a variety of different types of people that me as a guy from a small town in Minnesota had really never seen anything before or really met anybody different than myself before. So it was a really good experience from that perspective. And that helped me go to college. I've got tax-free college money for that. And then fast forward and now I'm working a dream job.
So, and you did get back from that mountain pass, I guess. Spoiler alert.
Yes, yes. Someone lost their weapon on the way down, so Ooh. That meant crawling back up and searching through a lot of snow, but we found it. Other than that, it was pretty darn fun.
Yeah, my recollection of the Army is that if you hadn't found that weapon, you'd still be looking for it.
Exactly.
They were exactly. crazy about that.
We were very motivated.
Yeah, that's great. So that joke you tell about, you know, them trying to impress the lieutenant and they were trying to terrorize you. I can remember I went to airborne school at one point where they teach you how to jump out of perfectly good airplanes.
Right.
But with parachutes. They're very important.
Of course.
And the very first time we were going, it turned out I was going to be the first guy out of the plane just because of an error of math. And the jump master was there and we're flying along at 1200 feet and it's my first jump and kind of exciting or, you know, you're a tiny bit nervous. And right. he looks at me and it's really loud and he says, "First jump, huh?" You know, these guys are right out of Central Casting. They're just like the guy in the movies. And he grabs the strap of my parachute and he pulls me closer to the door and he's not even attached. He has like a little a parachute on his back just in case he falls out of the plane. And he grabs me and he pulls me over and he goes, "Look how high up we are." And I just remember thinking, "You sadist."
Oh, man.
You know, what? What are you doing? Oh, but you know, you got to love their sense of humor. Cause I can remember, you know, when in the military, as you probably know, when they were killing a lot of time and there's a lot of waiting around in the army, they would say, "All right, who has questions? Who has questions?" And so I remember this one guy said, this one other person in airborne school said, you know, you have a main parachute in the back and you have an extra one in the front in case the main one doesn't activate. And the guy says, "Sergeant, when we jump out of the plane, if our main parachute fails to activate, how long will we have to activate the reserve parachute?" And the sergeant, he must have answered this question 1,000 times, and he stared at him and said, "You will have the rest of your life." So if you were listening for the jokes while you were in the Army, it could be a pretty funny thing. So, Lee, when I was at Content Marketing World a couple of years ago, I was the moderator for the influencer track, where I got to introduce people, and one of the guys was Lee Oden. And you gave a talk, and some other folks gave talks, and I've since, when I've read books about influencer marketing, you know, you're very often mentioned, as well as some of the other folks that were speaking at Content Marketing World that day. I want to ask you about some research that came out recently that you may not be aware of, but there was some research that came out, and it was the second Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails episode I did with Philip Stutz, and they have a marketing firm, but they also have a political firm. So they're always polling consumers for attitudes and awareness of certain things. And he contacted me and said, everything changed really drastically, like in those 2 weeks at the end of March. Everyone's mm-hmm. attitudes changed. And what I found interesting was he said that it was going to really impact a lot of influencers. And I was wondering, what's your read on, and the reason why is because he was arguing people weren't interested in seeing them on the beach. They were interested in safety and some other things that are a little further down Maslow's hierarchy of needs. What's been your read on what's going on with influencer marketing related to the coronavirus pandemic?
So luckily, most customers are not looking for influencers on the beach to buy enterprise software. And so in my case, I'm B2B specific. So in the consumer side, people that are really good at creating ephemeral content, temporal content, so stories-oriented content, Snapchat, Instagram stories, and so forth, those B2C-ish influencers in travel and hospitality, there's a lot that dried up right there real quick, real fast. And though at the same time, people are still looking for information, and some brands did shift how they engage those influencers rather than having them explicitly promote products or services or whatever, had them assist in talking about how that brand is going to help the world in this situation, or doing their part. On the B2B side, but the vast majority of those B2C influencers are, things have dried up quite a bit. Obviously, necessity is the mother of invention, or at least adversity can be, and people are pivoting and scrambling to find how they can create value. On the B2B side, we haven't seen that much of an impact, really. Business buyers, while, you know, don't want to see that same sort of, you know, explicit product offers and, you know, product experts touting products and services in the technology space, which is an area where we work in almost exclusively. But they do trust those people. They are paying attention to them in terms of what's going on in the industry in light of the pandemic, in light of these challenging times, as everyone's saying. So we have noticed that a number of influencers that, you know, an influencer isn't a job. I mean, for some people, it is a job. And those people who are using pro speaking and that were event centric, their revenue streams dried up.
Really quick. I've heard from a number of your fellow authors. Yeah.
All of a sudden they became very affordable to engage as influencers for brands.
Oh, I know. So they're able to talk to me all of a sudden. So, you know, look at you. I'm kidding.
So that's been interesting. And you know, good for everyone. I mean, so yeah, on the B2B side, we're engaging as many programs. I mean, we've had maybe one slowdown of one client. We hit all numbers in first quarter. We're ahead of the game in second quarter. These influencer programs, we have shifted and we pivoted a little bit, but clients are still investing, and influencers are still doing a great job at articulating value to customers. We're just doing it more and more empathetic weight according to the times.
Well, you say that they shifted a bit. Can you talk in broad terms about some of the changes that you see going on or some of the shifts that they've made?
So one of the, you know, with large brands, you know, they've come to understand that consumers expect those brands to be part of the solution, since some of the other sources of solution in this situation aren't necessarily, you know, getting it done. So, there is an expectation that large brands are going to be doing something to help the community, to help the communities in which they operate, relative to the pandemic. So, shifts from what I talked about, not so much talking about product marketing types of things, but talking more about purpose, talking more about why, being more empathetic to buyers and how the buyers' lives have changed now because supply chains have dried up or are affected, and that sort of thing. So that kind of shift. The other one is, you know, because of MarTech companies or other technology companies we get to work with, some of them are in a situation not like Zoom, you know, which is totally capitalized in this situation. Zoom will soon be a verb, or if it's not already, right?
Yeah.
Just like Google, but that provide services that help companies work remotely. So an example is Monday.com, which is a project management software. I think they're about a $2 billion company out of Israel. And they, your remote project management, you've got to have software, right? And I was just talking to someone the other day. They were telling me about a company, a technology company that had to move 100,000 employees to remote. They bought 90,000 computers, you know, and so there's a lot of other services those companies need to buy in order to make it work. And so there are companies that we work with. And so I can tell that story in terms of pivoting is that, you know, they have been able to capitalize on the fact that what they offer actually helps people solve very relevant and timely problems right now. They're not doing it in an explicit way, though. They're doing it in a, you know, they're giving away software to small businesses. They're giving access to their SaaS software to small businesses. And they're talking about how can you make the most out of the situation? What are best practices you can follow as you migrate from what you were doing to what the new normal or abnormal, as Anne Hanley would say, is happening. So that's been an interesting thing too. So it's just a couple of 2, 3, 4 companies like that, that I've seen, you know, be able to take advantage of the situation, but not opportunistically.
Sure, they're responding. They're helping.
Empathetic way.
Yeah. Did sales of Dell computers, was there a surge there for instances like you were just describing?
So we do happen to work with Dell. I wouldn't be able to answer that, but we do work with Dell Outlet and Dell. But from a consumer or small business computer standpoint, I can only imagine that they've seen positive effects, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. But it's also interesting that they can maybe talk about what they're doing to help rather than saying, we're here for you. I've seen an awful lot of kind of empty messages.
Right.
Just saying so, that, yeah.
Yeah, so even from a computer standpoint, and I'm just, you know, saying this as it comes to my mind right now, and that, you know, it's like, look, you know, if you imagine what is it like for a 25-person company, 100-person company that's now working remote that does use computers exclusively or you know, as a big part of their job, and, you know, they just weren't set up to have everyone take them home, you know, what kinds of information can you provide to them? You know, what kind of best practices, if you will, process information, worksheets, support, could you provide them, which all really is cost of sale content. You know, it's all part of it's marketing, but it's going to help them be successful. It's going to help them reduce stress, increase trust and confidence, what the way forward will be. And that's something I think, you know, senior folks who are decision makers are really going to appreciate. And I've seen that in terms of a response to helpful information. And that's also connected to what a lot of these brands are having influencers do. And it's not having them talk about how stuff so much, maybe a little bit, but more about the brands are talking about why, and the influencers are talking about giving useful information that is more in the how. You know what I mean? Like, here's how you should do this, or here's how you can do that, instead of why you should buy the product.
Yes. Well, now I want to ask you a question. You've got such a terrific blog, and there were a couple articles that caught my eye. And one of them was about some of the biggest fails of influencer marketing. It came out a while. What are some of the biggest mistakes, pandemic or not, that you see companies that are doing with influencer marketing?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, expectations that are just out of whack. The biggest one is someone who has this idea about what influencer marketing is, usually through the lens of B2C, usually through the lens of what they already know, which is often advertising oriented. So they're thinking about how can we buy access to people? And they'll have, you know, they'll come into it though with language like, well, we want to build our brand. We want to create more thought leadership for our brand. And in the same campaign, we want to increase leads. And those, as any marketer would know, are two different approaches. There's two different types of messaging for that, you know?
And if they try to do both, they probably won't be successful at either.
It can confuse people. Yeah. Like, you stand for this and then, oh, and buy a product. You know, we're changing the world one person at a time. And by the way, buy this product. It's like, wait, what? And so, that's an expectations management thing that, you know, if they are engaging in an agency and coming forward with those requests, then, you know, it's on the agency to, educate and persuade, well, here's how you can be successful, or here's how you can help your customers be successful. And here's how that layers out, as opposed to trying to do both with the same effort. That's one. Another one is looking at, well, it's, you know, one night stands, really. It's looking at influencer engagement only when you need them. So people get the idea that
probably too, all right,
I need someone to help me promote this thing is what they think. And like, they publish some content that doesn't have anything in it other than what the brand said. And then they published it and they go find some influencers to help us promote this thing. Mm-hmm. That's one version. And they only ask them when they need them to do that. And I think it's a big fail in a couple of ways. Number one, obviously it's very transactional and not very rewarding for someone to just come to you and say, hey, we just made this thing. Can you help promote it? And I'm like, and you are, why would I do that? I literally just got, this is a bit meta. I just got an email today from a fellow who said he's teaching an influencer marketing course, a virtual influencer marketing course. And could I give him a blurb to help him promote his course that he's being paid for? And I'm like, why would I do that? I mean, of course I would do it because I want to elevate the industry. But like, why would I do that? You know? And so the miss there is, and for the brand and for that person who emailed me, is if you include them in the content, now their investment is inspiration to help make it successful. Mm-hmm. And you may support them by giving them pre-written shares and things to talk about as far as amplification goes. But if they're part of the making, you know, it makes them care. And if they care, they're going to share, you know? And so the missed opportunity there is looking at it transactionally as if you can just buy it, or not even thinking about them until the day you actually need them. And to use a military metaphor, the best time to start an army is not the first day of the war. Right? So yes. It's sure it's happened a few times, but
it's what normally history, happens. But, yeah.
Yeah. And so those are a couple of things. I mean, they're just, you know, treating, not really realizing the value of relationships, not realizing the value of cumulative effect. So, well, people will be more sophisticated and they'll run a couple of campaigns throughout the year, but the campaigns will not be connected and they won't necessarily, manage the relationships with those influencers in between. And what happens is in B2B, there's a lot less, fewer influencers are actually paid, you know, and compensated with money. And so it's a value exchange. It's like, we'd like to invite you to be part of this program. We see that you care about the same things we do. Exposure in this program with our big brand could really, you know, be a win for everyone. And they'll say yes to that. But if you only do that and you only talk to them during those two or three campaigns throughout the year, there's nothing stopping them from going to your direct competitor. Mm-hmm. There's no, so relationships are the glue that keep that influencer aligned with your brand. And so you got to manage the relationship. You've got to allocate resources, technology, and humans to manage the relationship and keep the love alive.
Right. Well, just to remove the pressure, Lee Oden, you do not need to share this interview, okay? And I know you never hear that. I'm just kidding. But you know,
well, I'm part of the content, so I have a vested interest.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Well, let's be honest. This isn't really a money making thing, and frankly, this special series is so I can have people to talk to when I'm drinking, and it's a favor to my family. You know, so you're sort of like doing Douglas daycare, and they thank
awesome.
You. And I'm sure they're messaging you right now saying, can you keep him on there a little bit longer? But your comment about the one-night stand, it brings to mind a book that was on the podcast in early 2020. It was Social Media Success for Every Brand by Claire Diaz-Ortiz, who I think was the sixth employee at Twitter, which is why her Twitter handle is at Claire, like at Jack Dorsey.
Yeah.
And she talks about how she was doing work for a tech firm, a startup, you know, putting together a big marketing plan. And she said that the management, the founder and so forth, they were, you know, they were looking through it and thinking, yeah, we see what you're doing. We got it, you know. But, you know, we don't really need to do this. If we could just get Mark Cuban to tweet about us. And she pretty much anchored her whole book around that. She started it with that. And I just thought it was amazing because she said there's so many that think that, yeah, well, just this yeah. one thing will suddenly get viral. Well, then actually she goes beyond that and says, okay, well, so what happens if he does do that? He said most people aren't even ready for that. So I had to laugh when you mentioned that. Now, and I'm gonna link to that article on this episode show notes at marketingbookcocktails.com. But there was one other that was pretty recent, and it was about measuring changing marketing goals during a crisis. So yeah. Things are changing. What are companies measuring instead? I guess.
So. Because more companies are empathetically talking about how they can support the communities in which their customers live and work in, they're starting to not just measure obviously leads and sales, and you know just traditional KPIs. Although they still need to, you know, there's still content, there's still marketing happening, there's still advertising happening, so they have to continue to measure those things. But I think more companies are measuring share of voice, brand affinity, sentiment. Mm-hmm. Because I think one of the important questions for brands to answer is at the end of this, or as things do become a little more normal at some point, are people going to think of your brand as a champion, as one with integrity, as one that is trusted, that they can be confident about doing business with going forward? or are they going to look back on you as an opportunistic organization that just continued to do tone deaf marketing and really didn't empathize with its customers and didn't create value for its customers? And I think this is something that a lot of senior executives are thinking about in one way or another. And that's filtering down to marketing and the types of communications and marketing communications that's happening, and subsequently the measurement that goes along with that. And in terms of, you know, to what degree are people discovering or engaging with that content, and to what degree are they doing the thing that they're asking people to do, whether that's to join them in an altruistic endeavor, signing up, you know, and consuming content, referring it, sharing it, but also those other things I mentioned: share of voice, sentiment, and affinity.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything related to search since the pandemic started that has surprised you or changed?
Yeah, a big increase in organic search for certain types of services. G2 Crowd put out an article via Marketing Profs that they had shared some of the organic search trends that had happened on their site. And they were seeing 200 to 600% increases in organic referred search traffic to certain types of technology content. Content like online teleconferencing, virtual conferences, and that sort of thing. Outside of that, none of the industries, of course, you're going to see a drop. People aren't looking for hotels or flights and that sort of thing as much anymore, but they are still looking. In fact, there's been an increase in people looking, using search as a way to connect themselves to solutions. You know, people have always used search that way to sort of bypass the middleman of sales, in order to educate them and pull themselves through the sales cycle with information, which is most often surfaced through peers or through search. I often like to say, you know, peer networks and influencers can give people an idea about a solution, but then people will go to search, and search will validate that is a good solution, that it's, as we like to say, the best answer for that particular problem. And so search has been extremely valuable, where customers can pull themselves to solutions in their own terms, and not have to deal with some of this stupid, not thoughtful, marketing that people are still doing in a tone deaf way.
Yes. And that's something that has me hopeful, because I'm a hopeful person, Lee. You know, I'm looking for the silver lining.
You do seem a little optimistic, Douglas. You do.
Well, I'm hopeful that because of this, because we, even in this conversation where you've talked about tone deafness and people being, there's like a heightened concern about how people are going to be perceived. That's not a bad thing going forward for the next generation of marketers and businesses who are being kind of sensitive to what they're saying. And I was just talking to an author the other day, and I can't remember because, you know, all these drinks and all these interviews, they kind of blur together. and your name again? No. But they were talking about how there are certain offers that they were probably already queued up, or certain campaigns that they were going to be doing anyway, and then maybe they just changed a few words to, like, life insurance, like a campaign for
in these challenging times.
Yes. Oh gosh,
we're here for you.
That's right. That's right. And you've probably seen that video of how so many of these COVID-19 TV commercials are the same. Now, it was brilliantly edited, but it looked like one big 3 or 4 minute commercial.
Yeah,
with different brand names on there. So, is there anything else that's really surprised you?
I see. You know, there's a lot of community happening. I, from an optimistic, I'll continue on that optimistic or hopeful thread. I mean, do see a lot of community happening where people are using social media to kind of talk about what they're going through. And of course, what's great about social media is that you can find people with like-minded individuals. You can connect with other people that are wondering about the same kinds of things and have dialogue, or people who don't agree with you, and you can have a dialogue. And I am seeing a lot more certain types of community, if you will, happening as a result of this. People are spending more time on digital. They're spending more time communicating in ways and in more interesting ways. I mean, for example, I saw Anne Hanley tap dance the other day in her tiny house. Now, I had no idea Anne was, I mean, she's a remarkable individual, of course, but I had no idea that she, and so there's all these gifts of her doing these interesting things. And I see other people starting shows and it's really interesting how they're creating community between themselves and their audiences. But to see, you know, an increasing number of marketers embrace digital media content creation in ways they weren't before because they have to now, and how they're sharing ideas with each other is another level of community I've seen grow as well. And I can only imagine some of that exists in other industries outside of marketing.
Yeah, I can recall now there's like a Facebook page for my college classmates. And there's these digital happy hours popping up.
Right.
And
yes.
There's no sign that it's going to be stopping anytime soon. Everyone's having so much fun reconnecting and now suddenly realizing that they can do that and they can all get together and, you know, basically tell lies about each other and deny certain things in case the wives are listening in. But at any rate, well, Lee, I really appreciate the opportunity to reconnect with you here on Authors in Quarantine, Getting Cocktails, which I'm going to do until I run out of quarantine or authors. And I think I'm going to run out of authors first. But I hope that you and your family and your team at the agency there continue to stay safe and happy and safe and relatively sane.
Well, I wish the same for you, Douglas. And keep growing that beard. It's looking pretty impressive.
And that's coming from Lee Oden, the guy that used to have a beard.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.